Hello. When your mind is... Hi, Charles.
Here's a miracle. The sound system is working.
That's not a miracle, that's called technology, Charles.
When you say that, would swear I was trying to use technology last week. But anyway, thumbs up from Anthony for that, so that's good news. Well, welcome and good evening, Graham. Chilly outside, suitably wintry conditions. But actually, when it came to you suggesting topics, bizarrely and freakishly, they were the very topics that I thought would be interesting to discuss tonight as well.
Weird. It's almost like we've known each other for 35 years.
Exactly. It's a telepathy over that. But I guess perhaps we should just start with a finale to our TAR discussions last week, which again have centered actually that subsequently this week. There's been still further discussions on the role of women conductors in the classical world. And the question that I was asking last week was whether, in some ways, she was actually showing characteristics, the conductor leading the Berlin Orchestra, she was showing characteristics of bad behavior that would be more attributed to men than women, and whether that was a pointless comment on my part, or whether actually that was the case, whether she was competing in a man's world, or whether she was so determined and ruthless in everything she did that wasn't why she was how she was, that was simply her character.
No, I think it's worse than that. Having thought about the film again, I think the film was definitely, it was structured in a very, very sneaky fashion. So it was told from her point of view, but it left gaps. So suddenly she'd be in trouble, and it'd be from her point of view she'd be in trouble. So it made you slightly sympathise with her. But although it was told from her point of view, it missed out the bit where she actually did the things that got her in trouble, thus creating a sort of fake sympathy. But thinking about it, I think the film was implying that she was guilty of all the offences, which isn't a problem in itself. You know, a female conductor abusing her position, behaving badly, being a huge ego, being horrible. It's not a problem in itself, except for one slight problem. How come when Hollywood or anybody else makes films about egomaniac male characters who are creative, like Listomania by Ken Russell about the composer, all that jazz about Bob Fosse, the autobiographical film about the famous American choreographer.
Amadeus.
Or even Raging Bull, Scorsese's film about the self-destructive, egotistical boxer. How come in all those three occasions where these people behave, because in Raging Bull, Jake LaMotta's beating up his wife regularly. Yeah. So how come in all those three occasions, male films about male egomaniacs, they're still portrayed as heroic in some ways. But in Tar, Cate Blanchett, who behaves no worse than those three characters in general, doesn't seem to be allowed to be a hero. She's just a villain. And I don't get the point of the film.
I mean, it's interesting because I find myself neither sympathising or empathising, so I would back your point on that. Her motivations for why she did what she did was partly what I struggled with, that she had to be that ruthless at all times when ultimately it was going to be self-destructive. But maybe that's the point, that self-destructive people cannot help themselves. If you call her a creative genius in her own way, the counter to that is the self-destruction that ate away at her at all times.
Yeah, but that isn't totally the point, Charles, although you're totally correct.
Yes.
The point is that when we saw the documentary about Stockhausen, he was shown to be treating people appallingly in a very egotistical fashion and treating women in a very selfish, greedy, duplicitous, heartless fashion. And yet he still ends up being the good guy in the film, in this documentary. And on top of that, the woman who he's treated badly bend over backwards to forgive him and to say how great he was. And Tar doesn't get that. Tar is tarred with an entirely bad brush.
That's right. I mean, in the, you're right. In the film on Stockhausen, they were kind of almost bending over themselves, each of them, to sort of justify how he was and to and in their enthusiasm for him. And actually, his own enthusiasm for creativity was a truly poetic statement within the film. That doesn't mean to say that his behavior was beyond, was clearly beyond the pale, but you did actually get an insight into his genius in a way that was far more believable, I felt, than the film Tar. Now, that could be actually because it is a documentary based on truth, whereas the character in Tar, although it's been said it's not directly based on a composer working in Berlin with a comparatively similar story, there is, for all the fact, the fine actress that Cate Blanchett is, there was for me still a something of a distance watching her as a conductor. I didn't wholly believe in that either.
Yeah, well, it's quite hard to play a conductor when you're not a conductor, because conductors obviously are a unique species. I
So,
think the
except
problem
bus
with the film
conductors,
is that,
Graham.
yeah, obviously, a bus conductor. Don't, no, there are no bus conductors. They're now driver conductors. So,
That's the
yeah,
one.
there's no bus conductors. Yeah. But I think the other thing about Tar is that if it was just a mediocre film, it wouldn't be so annoying. But it's a very good film, and because it's a very good film, you start to pick it at its meaning, and that's when you when I find it sort of falling short of the standards it set itself. I'd who made it? I don't understand what the overall point in the film was, except as a great study of an egotistical, creative semi-genius. I don't, I didn't get what they were trying to say, if they were trying to say anything.
So why is it being so highly rated across the board?
Well, it's got a great script, great dialogue. It's fascinating. Cate Blanchett is brilliant. You know, technically, it's a great film. I mean, it's about as good a film as you can make about a conductor. Because let's face it's not the world's greatest subject for an entertaining movie, is a film about a classical conductor.
No, it's rather like the referee in football making a film about the referee, isn't
Well, yeah, can you imagine a film about a referee?
it? Maybe I'm trivializing the significance of the great conductors of our time, but
Don't think so. What about a film about
without the
a
musicians
tennis
and
ball
without the
boy or a blonde
composers,
girl at Wimbledon?
I think that's taking it too far, Graham.
I mean,
But
could you make a good film like that? You
no.
could make a sort of sloppy, sentimental British semi-comedy about a ball girl or a ball boy at Wimbledon, I
Exactly.
suppose.
Yeah.
With
And
Judi
remember.
Dench as like the
Oh, yeah.
Judi Dench is the former British female Wimbledon champion of the 1950s. Yeah, that would work.
That would be the one. That would be the one. While we have reservations about Tar, it is extremely high quality filmmaking, as well as having these reservations that we've got. You've pointed out the many strengths within the film, the technical side of it, the extremely good script within it, the atmosphere that's created within it, the fact that it's a story that's driven by women, which is still not commonplace in filmmaking. And again, there is an element of the woman striving against a male-dominated world, which is what we saw obviously in the scenes where she's brought before the council and stony faces all round, and largely meeting opprobrium from men in the film. So again, of value. So that was th that film. Now we could,
I
I
was going to
guess,
say one last thing.
yeah,
One
please
interesting
do.
thing that I thought on after I'd seen it at the cinema in Harrogate was that
Yeah.
in the scene where she's horrible to the young black music student,
Yes.
lecture that she's giving, and
Yeah.
he is like on his high horse, PC,
Yeah.
holier than thou type spiel. So you could see why she might get a little bit annoyed,
Yeah.
but she treats him terribly. But the interesting thing in that whole scene is that the director makes a great point at all times of showing that the young student's leg is shaking the whole time, that he's
Yes.
bravely taking her on because he argues with her and doesn't back down in front of the
No.
rest of the students. And she's a legend, and he's only a student, and his
Yeah.
leg's shaking the whole time. And I think, why have they shown that? I think they're showing it because he knows he's taking a risk by doing that.
Yeah.
He knows he's taking on a legend. But it also suggests that she's already got a reputation for being less than nice.
Yeah.
Otherwise, why is he so nervous? So that was a little clue that the film is leading you towards thinking she's a bad guy or a bad girl.
Indeed. So Tar still showing at cinemas around here, but maybe gradually going to fade away because there's a glut of new films on the way, of which you and I, lo and behold, first opportunity to see Babylon. You took that opportunity. I took that opportunity. I went at 9 o'clock at night and was coming out of the cinema at about 30:30. That's how long a film
And
Babylon
did you fall asleep
was.
then? Did you fall asleep, Charles?
No, bizarrely, I got the sleep
Ooh,
in before
wow.
going to the cinema. So
Okay.
there were moments in the film that I wished I perhaps had been asleep.
Oh, really?
Technically, it's running time 3 hours and 9 minutes. So I suppose to set the background of this film, Damien, you can pronounce his surname,
Chazelle.
Chazelle,
Damien
who made,
Chazelle,
of
yeah.
course, the Oscar-winning La La Land, which in its own way was a
Overrated.
and now you see, there we are. I think that's one of those films that, on reflection, that would be true. At the time, it was hugely enjoyable, but actually, as the years have ticked
The
by,
best thing is the dance scene. The dance scene on the
yes,
overpass in LA is
yeah.
truly brilliant.
So, but that's right
But
at the
that's the
start of the
best thing about
film.
it.
That's right at the start of the
Yeah,
film, really, as well.
yeah. But Whiplash is
But
better because it's
so
his
La La Land was, in its
first.
own way, again, a hymn to Hollywood. This, and we'll come on to a comparison with another new film later, but on the one level, this is a film about the magic of Hollywood, but actually, it's much grimier than that. And if I say to you that there's a, in the Independent today, it says, "Why Babylon's ending might be the most nauseating in the history of cinema." So that kind of reaction is suddenly happening to this film. There's
Yeah.
also and social media as well. The most vile scenes in Babylon. So I think as it develops, the I'm not saying the trailer is misleading, Graham, but it makes it
It's
look a whole
misleading,
more.
Charles.
Yeah, let's be honest, it's misleading.
Yeah.
So the background to
It's a
this
very
film, Graham, what would you say the background to the film is? I mean, it's of the era of silent films moving
Well,
towards
but
the jazz singer.
what I think what he's trying to do is that he's trying to portray early Hollywood in the silent movie era, then sort of moving into the talkies. He's trying to portray it as an era of like Wild West type freedom, but also spectacular decadence. And it's all about the fickle nature of producers and actors and audiences and the fickle nature of fame and the rumbustious mess of the whole thing. And I think he's trying to recapture that spirit by making the film bizarrely full of really wild spectacular tangents. So, for example, very early on, as you know, in the film, you've got an elephant crapping all over someone's face. Then you've got an actress peeing on some semi-naked man's body at a party. And then towards the end, you've got a ludicrous scene where the good guy in the film ends up going into sort of like mine shaft with a gangster, who then shows him like a whole variety of weirdness going on,
Creatures.
including a crocodile. And it's like 1 minute the film's sort of like quite measured, serious film about the early days of Hollywood. And next minute it's just like completely over the top. And I think in his head, Damien Chazelle might have thought that by doing this, he's simultaneously having a bit of depth to the movie, but he's also being as anarchic and wild and free as the early days of Hollywood. But it just ends up a completely schizophrenic, meandering, sort of like very lively, punchy movie without any fixed point or any fixed purpose.
I mean,
What did you
I
think?
say that on one level, and obviously the scene right at the end, which is of the character who is he's the journey of the Mexican character who will do anything to move up the ranks in Hollywood, and the
Well,
film
he's a nice guy. He is a genuinely nice guy, but
he is a nice guy. He's the one who has to push the elephant vehicle up the hill at the start. Now, but at the end of the film, much I'm going to compare the other film we're going to talk about to Cinema Paradiso, but there is this thing of him looking at film at the end and being in floods of tears as he looks at film. And we go through the whole history of film effectively in that scene while he sits there crying in that moment. And that's where I'm somewhat confused again about, is this ultimately a film that's in love with film or not? Because on the one hand, it is trying to make points about the behavior, what people had to do, how they were treated. But the Margot Robbie character, for example, her, I was expecting that there'd be something more truthful rather than making out essentially because out of her head on drugs all the time, ill-educated, undergoes a kind of Eliza Doolittle conversion. But what I expected, given what's happened with Me Too, etc., is actually truthfulness in this film about how women were treated in the early days of Hollywood. And we don't get that. That's not how it's presented.
No, you get
She's
glimpses
seen as
of that.
self-destructive, isn't she?
You get glimpses of that. They do show how women are used, but the director doesn't make a point from that point. He keeps on having all these little scenes that technically seem to make a point, but then he doesn't address the point.
No.
He's just like his other films, he's not capable of dealing with narrative depth. He's a very shallow director. And the point about the storyline, which runs through these spectacular moments of decadence and sex and violence and shock, is the storyline itself is the same storyline of every single film that Hollywood has made about Hollywood in the last 50, 60 years. They've all got the same storyline. So the narrative that's supposed to support this whole brilliantly directed, because he's a great director technically, but the storyline is supposed to support all his talent, all his genius, and he's all his showmanship. The storyline is just a bunch of cliches. If it wasn't the fact that Margot Robbie is a great actress and Brad Pitt in particular is sensational, the film would fall totally flat because it's just a string of unoriginal cliches that makes no new points that haven't been made multiple times in films about Hollywood. And I'm beginning to think that Damien Chazelle, who's a very talented director, just doesn't have enough intellect to tackle the subjects that he himself creates.
I mean, compare it, Graham. Well, two films, I think, recent films to compare it with. Baz Luhrmann, whose influence seems to me to be written all over this film, for his version of The Great Gatsby, which I think is a vastly superior film. And the other film is Quentin Tarantino, Once Upon a Time
Oh,
in Hollywood, which,
Once
of
Upon a Time
course,
in Hollywood by Tarantino is so much more sophisticated
exactly.
intellectually. Who would have thought you'd say that about Tarantino, the master of violence in shock? It's just intellectually superior by
Yeah.
miles to Babylon, don't you
And
think?
it has a much clearer journey that it's taking. And the woman's story within that, the Sharon Tate story, there's the beautiful scene where she gets to watch herself on screen. There's the extraordinary finale where the Hell's Angels really are seen to be torched alive and get their damn deserved comeuppance. All
Well,
that may be seen.
Charles Manson's Gang of Murderers is what it is.
And so on the one hand, that's fantastic, all those elements to it. But I thought, as a hymn to Hollywood, it was a far, far stronger piece than this. This kept wanting to shock for no particular reason. And even the Eliza Doolittle moment where she ends up projectile vomiting. I mean, this is the Margot Robbie character. Again, why?
It wasn't that funny.
No. Well, now
Yeah, and it wasn't that funny.
you've hit on a crucial thing there, Graham. I think the comedy is completely mistimed throughout. It's never got the correct weight, not even in the brilliance of Brad Pitt, who can do wonderful comic timing in his work. It
But
even
Brad is
he even
superb in
he,
this.
yeah,
Without Brad, the film falls apart. He's
completely,
absolutely brilliant. He's as good as Clark Gable was
yeah,
when Clark Gable was good an awful long time ago. Very good. But
but.
I just think that ultimately Damien Chazelle is a really talented guy, but he's just all sensation and emotion and not
Yeah.
enough intellect.
And if you're going to make a 3 hour, nine
Whereas
minute
Baz
film,
Luhrmann has bigger ideas.
yeah, he does. I
It
mean, there are certain.
did race by. I wasn't bored.
No, I
It's
get
not a
that.
boring
But
film.
on the
It's
other hand, if you're going to do 3 hours and
important.
9 minutes, you do expect some sense of grand statement within it. And I didn't feel I ever quite got that statement in, well, not with sufficient clarity.
Well, what he
It
did
ended up
was
being a
this.
version of Babylon where speaking in different tongues, as it were, and
Babbling
not
on.
making a lot of sense.
Yeah, but
Babel,
you
I
hit the
mean,
nail on the head.
Babel.
At the end scene where the Mexican character's crying, watching Singing in the Rain,
Yeah.
suddenly interrupts, Damien Chazelle interrupts that scene to have this 3 or 4 minute magnificent montage of the history of famous films
Yeah.
over the last 90 years. And as an actual montage and a feat of editing, it's absolutely dazzlingly brilliant. But it's what's the point of it? It's almost like you thought, oh, I really haven't got an ending. what can I do to give it an ending? I'll tell you what, I'll do a dazzling montage of all the greatest movie moments of the last 90 years. So again, it's like he's got the talent, but he hasn't got the idea. He hasn't got the ideas. He hasn't got the tone. He's just like, it's like he's missing something. He's like a shallow filmmaker for a shallow age.
The Tobey Maguire scenes, Tobey Maguire is a co-producer. Do we kind of assume that that's why Tobey Maguire suddenly gets to do those, frankly, vastly over-the-top scenes that you've referred to earlier that actually serve very little function? Am I just reading too much into, Tobey Maguire thinking, yeah, I'm
I
co-producing,
think
give me 10 minutes,
they both thought, because they're in the spirit of production, in the spirit of the subject matter, all this Wild West Hollywood movie making in the 1920s, I think they thought it was going to be funny. I think they thought, okay, what can we do in the spirit of the 1920s? We'll have Tobey Maguire playing the world's most over-the-top, ridiculous gangster of really moral turpitude. And I think they thought it was going to be funny. But that whole scene isn't funny. It's just a bit yuck. It's just a bit yuck.
Did one scene where maybe the comic element worked quite well, but again, I thought it was overplayed, is the scene where Margot Robbie's character is filming a talkie for the first time, and it's take however many takes it takes, and it gets more and more stressful. Did you think the comic momentum of that almost works? That one long, long sequence.
No, I don't think it was that funny, and I think to push it to, was it take seven or take eight? I just didn't think it got any more funny as it went along. It's just a matter of judgment. There's just a bit of judgment that goes wrong. My favorite scene in the whole film is when the famous old movie critic, who's very powerful in Hollywood, based on a real person. I know it's,
Yeah,
can't remember her name, but she did exist.
header and based on header and I can't remember the name of the other critic,
That's
but
right, yeah. She has the heart to heart with Brad Pitt because his career starts to
you've picked the
decline.
best scene, Graham. You've picked the best scene.
Brad wants to know why she wrote a hideous article about him in a famous film magazine. And she tells him the truth. And Brad sits there and tries to argue a bit, but eventually accepts the truth. And that whole tete-a-tete, one-to-one scene with those two completely works. It's totally believable, totally real, and it's really good. And if the rest of the film
And
had more of that, it would have been a better film.
it's interesting because that scene has no excess, no depravity. It is a conversation, a frank conversation. And even the way that scene ends with his very brief comment of acceptance, followed by her going back to click, 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 click on the typewriter, was beautifully judged. But that was very rare in the film. That moment
Exactly.
had the weight and balance that was needed elsewhere in the film. The one I
If
wanted to just
that if
go on, Graham. Go
I'm just thinking, if Damien Chazelle was Spinal Tap the movie,
Yeah.
he just needs to turn the notch on the volume control on the amplifier down to about six, because right now he's got it at 11 or 12, and it's just not working.
He has. The film I wanted to maybe compare it with, I don't know if you've seen Empire of Light yet. Have you seen that yet?
No, I haven't.
So that's Sam Mendes's
No.
film, which is in its own way is a hymn to cinemas. Set on in a coastal resort's old-fashioned cinema, which is its upper levels are still there, but they're closed, so it's a limited use of the screens. And it's a story starring Olivia Colman, who works at the cinema, has a schizophrenic personality, and ends up in some form of relationship with the young ticket collector played by Michael Ward, directed by Sam Mendes. And with Colin Firth playing
Great director.
the manager of the cinema, who keeps expecting Olivia Colman's character to give him sexual gratification that his wife obviously is no longer giving him.
Really?
Yeah, it's
It's a
very,
popular
very, it's
party.
very, very English in every way. And some critics have said the one problem with it is that Sam Mendes isn't great at writing scripts, but the directing is very good. Now, I felt that. It did always it there is sometimes that thing where English films just feel a little bit little. They just do. They couldn't it wouldn't this film wouldn't be made in that way in America. But you can have a film that's made on a scale like this that works far better, to which I kept feeling Cinema Paradiso, this film is trying to capture that magic of cinema that was caught in Cinema Paradiso.
British films do a little a lot, don't they? There's an awful lot of small British movies, which drives me crazy. There's not enough ambition, not enough, ideas. It's all very parochial and very, side street, and it sort of drives me. I've not rushed to see Emperor Light, because although I like Sam Mendes, the director, I didn't like the sound of the story. But it's got Roger Deakins doing the cinematography, so I'm sure it looks brilliant.
So the cinematography does capture that wonders of film. For me, the moments that work really beautifully actually are with Toby Jones, who's such a wonderful actor in anything that he touches. He's the projectionist, and his scenes capture what it's like to work within the world of presenting films to the public and what joy he gets from that. And that does come across, that little parochial cinema that he's been at for years, presenting the films in that traditional way. And there is, in the cinematography, there is a magic of how film is created. And for Michael Ward's character, Toby Jones goes through explaining to him how it all works, and that is beautifully done. That's where it's most hymnal in tone to the wonders of going to the cinema, and that is the thing I guess one enjoys about it most. At the same time, you have a man who comes to the cinema who's racist and rude, because Michael's character is a young black man. Later in the film, he is beaten up by a bunch of skinheads who are following a mob march through the coastal resort, and that scene in its own way is the kind of grit that the film keeps trying to bring amongst the more romantic side of the film as well. And again, the balance isn't. I don't think the film that I would like. I don't feel it quite captures the magic of cinema, but I do feel it's kind of almost too aware of the world of Cinema Paradiso. So it decided to go for that kitchen sink drama side of English drama, which we're more confident in doing than capturing the magic realism, if you like. So it's very different in tone, very different in tone to Babylon. But I think, as with the three films we've looked at today, they're none of them in any way perfect. And in the case of Babylon, I think it's a film that in time is going to be looked on in pretty negative ways,
I'm not
because
totally
time goes
sure. It
by.
wasn't boring. For a 3-hour film not to be boring is some sort of achievement.
Yeah, that's true. Now, Graham, our other topic of the evening. This was one of those weird moments when I was thinking, I wonder if Belle and Sebastian are doing anything. And it was more in relation to trying to remember when they were going to be playing on tour. Lo and behold, when I went onto the website, album coming out. I thought, what, already? And lo and behold, that was one of those freakish moments. Sure enough, out comes this album at very, very short notice called Late Developers. Give me the story about how this has come out.
Well, it was actually recorded at the same time as their most recent album, a bit of Previous, which, as you know, came out last year. And they were recorded at the same time in Glasgow, a sort of return to the roots for a band that formed about 1994. So it's quite a lengthy career now. And you might think, well, maybe it should have been a double album. But when you play both the albums, you realise that would have been a bit of a mistake. I think it would have been better as a single album. I think they could have got a really good album out of the two albums edited down. But it's as usual, the thing about Belle and Sebastian is they don't do bad songs or bad albums, because Stuart Murdoch in particular is such a great pop songwriter. He's probably up there with XTC and maybe McCartney, not in the sense that all these songs are brilliant, but every song is catchy. He doesn't do anything except catchy. And
No.
there's not many songwriters can be catchy after catchy after catchy forever. And he just keeps on churning out catchy pop songs. It's just incredible. But have you heard it yet, Charles?
I have, Graham. I bought it on the day it came out. As that as ever, I
What
was that enthusiastic.
did you think?
Well, I think I mean, in the past, I think what they would have done is a single album from it and a series of EPs with all the other tracks, which in some ways would have been more my expectation. But maybe they decided on reflection. Well, I mean, it's interesting to know whether they thought they'd picked the strongest tracks for a bit of Previous, and then thought, well, hold on, actually, no, there's enough extra songs here to make another album's worth. I would assume the original principle was to pick the strongest songs. But I would think it would be fair to say that this album, in its own way, is every bit as strong as Late Developers is every bit as strong as, well, as it was a bit of the previous album. And as ever with Belle and Sebastian, the more you play, the more the subtleties within the songs come through. Also, again, you've got a brass section, you've got cello. There's always a beautiful balance of musicianship within it. And then you have the delight of, should anyone have been missing Camera Obscura, and who hasn't? I mean, they're probably the nearest comparison of a band in Scotland to Belle and Sebastian in terms of their songwriting. And Tracey Ann Campbell from Camera Obscura has contributed the guest vocal to When the Cynics Stare Back from the
Oh,
Wall.
yeah. Good track, that, yeah.
Now, one track, interestingly, Graham, is dating from 1994, the actual construction of the song. And it's going to escape me which one it is. Now, maybe it is that one.
Definitely escapes me. I didn't even know that.
Yes, so, and I'm sorry not to actually have that information to hand. It was, I read it somewhere so one song is from all that time ago, and it may well be the one that Tracey Ann Campbell sings on. I was looking at the lyrics for the title track, Late Developers, and just this is the first verse. Live inside your head, get out of your bed, brush the cobwebs off, wash your crazy mop, dry with so much care. Have you thought of this? The objects of your love probably don't exist. And so starts with romanticism, but dashed, goes on right at the end through, it goes through a kind of older man's, Murdoch must now be cracking on to what, towards 50, probably?
Easily,
In
yeah.
age? Yeah. And so the song goes through more negative thoughts, ends up, however, saying, you're hanging by a thread, a lifeline to your cloud. Slip into my pocket, I won't rat you out. I'll take you to places where they sing their hearts out, thundering joy. I'm loving the people who lift up their voices strong and loud. And I don't think it's insignificant that that is the closing song, and that is about as upbeat a finish as you could have. He is a man of faith. He even mentions worship in one of the songs, and hence you have that image there, loving all the people who lift up their voices strong and loud. I think in part, looking at the sleeve, you'll see in the center of that, there are protest images. So signs of, can we please put the smart people in charge? You'll die of old age. We'll die of climate change. Choose eco, not ego. And that's what he's obviously saying as well, is that those who are raising their voices against what's going on, they're the ones that he wants to champion.
Well, the one good thing about Belle and Sebastian is they've always had a point. Stuart Murdoch always does have a point. And the sleeve and the booklet are absolutely superb as always. I mean, they're such brilliantly little
His
bits of artwork.
Photography
and the
again, Graham.
Photographs,
Yeah.
Yeah, the photographs are always of his native Glasgow, and they're always interesting.
Mm.
I think if you were to imagine that Belle and Sebastian were a new band in their early 20s and this album came out, you'd be hailing them as, like, fantastic.
You would.
But there's
You
a
would.
Slight problem. This is about their 12th, 13th album.
Yeah.
They're not a new band, and we have heard almost all of it before. It's a bit like if you play the Rolling Stones 1974 album, It's Only Rock and Roll, not having heard any previous album, it's a great album. But if you play it after Sticky Fingers and Excellent Main Street and Let It Bleed, it's not a great album. And I think Belle and Sebastian got to that point where they can't do anything new, and they haven't done anything new since probably they went a bit Euro Disco in 2014 on Girls in Peacetime Just Want to Dance album. And that's been it. They can't go any further. They've played all the tunes they can play. They've done all the styles they can do. And they've been brilliant. And they're still really good. The standard's still really high. But nothing's new. Nothing's essential. Nothing they do now can take over what they've done before. They've reached that point in their career where they've come full circle. At the beginning, they used to write songs about what it was like to be adolescent and leaving adolescence towards adulthood in a very intelligent, questioning, witty way. But now they write songs about looking back, wishing they were still adolescent.
He
So
does.
They can't seem to shake off their adolescent roots. They're in a loop of, like, moving out of adolescence, then looking back at what it was like to be in that situation and missing being in that situation. And so I think they're a band who, while still being worth listening to, that their journey is complete.
Yes, that one's direct song title addressing that, When We Were Very Young.
Exactly.
I mean, that's... It's interesting because the quality of the songs is still incredibly high, but you're right. I couldn't say you've highlighted the one time there was some sense of progression, and it's not that they've regressed since then. It is to, again the it doesn't go anywhere new. It is merely really, really strong writing still, and as I say, beautiful use of a cello, beautiful use of the brass section, superb lyric writing as ever, a moral conscience that I like, a sense of romance that I love about them. But do you think that there will come a point where actually they become redundant?
Because the quality of the songwriting is still so high and Stuart Murdoch's still got lots of lyrical ideas, I don't think so. I can't see them ever turning out rubbish.
Mm.
But I do think at some point you might think, what more have I got to say in the confines of Bell and Sebastian?
Mm.
But obviously I could be entirely wrong. They're such a stable little unit, even though they've lost a few members in their early years. They've had the same sort of core of him and Chris Geddes and Steve Nash and Zaire Martin for a good long time. So it may be that even just because I think we can't go anywhere new, doesn't mean that Stuart Murdoch will agree.
Mm. I still wonder whether there's a filmmaker in Stuart Murdoch.
It's more like to be a novelist or something. He did a musical once, didn't he? Write About Love. That was a musical, wasn't it?
He did. He did. Mm. He's also been on Question Time, of course, isn't he? So, with his hat on.
Yeah.
I do not want to cast negative thoughts on this album whatsoever, but it is, I would say, Graham, that the level of consistency is rare that a band sustains that. I mean, I've mentioned comparisons with the band James in the levels of consistency of songwriting. What maybe one hasn't seen is something like how Suede have come back with a vivacity beyond any expectation that would be the case. And that's been reinvigorating for Suede, that they did that on their latest album. Instead, with Belle and Sebastian, it is consistent quality.
Basically, they do perky pop and they do contemplative slight balladry.
You've been listening to the podcast Two Big Egos in a Small Car. Your hosts were Graham Chalmers and Charles Hutchinson. This was a Baltic Sub production.